Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
All right, guys, welcome back to Conspiranormal. It's good to be back tonight, guys. We've got a special treat because we have a guest that we haven't had on in quite a while. It's been, I think, maybe 4 years, maybe something like that. Although I have definitely interacted with this gentleman since then. But that is Mr. Greg Bishop. Greg, welcome back to the show, man.
Hey, guys, how's it going?
It is going well.
Good.
It is going well.
Mr. Radio Mysterioso.
That's right.
I've got about 6 shows ready to go. I just haven't released them yet because I'm so damned lazy. So there'll be shows on Radio Mysterioso coming up.
Everybody's wondering where Radio Mysterioso has been.
I've been doing interviews with people. I've got, like I said, I've got 6 interviews sitting there just in the can. And one of them is the last interview with David Perkins because I went to his house.
Yeah.
And talked to him for like an hour and a half or something. That's all he could take because he was so weak. He just, let's do one last interview. I said, David, don't say that. Come on. I'll just see you in a few months. And it was the last interview.
Yeah.
Wow. But I mean, there's nothing in there. It's like, oh my God, he's never admitted that before. He basically reiterated what he said and said, I don't know what's going on. I think it has something to do with the planetary consciousness fighting back at us. That was his main idea. And I think he stuck with that, but he wasn't married to it. He was one of those people that have a specific theory, but they don't really care. They don't think that's encompasses everything. And there's a few people that I really like to talk to that have that kind of have that attitude. They got a favorite, but it could change, you know?
Right. Well, you know, one of the reasons I had you on tonight, we had you on really for 2 reasons, is that you're going to be doing the first online event coming up on April 24th for Strange Realities.
Mm-hmm. Of the year.
But yeah, first online event of the year. But also, too, you know, I watched not long ago the Octopus documentary that was on Netflix.
I haven't seen it yet, damn it.
I liked it. I thought it was a good documentary, but I know some people were really miffed that Ken Thomas was not mentioned at all in it.
Yeah, they showed the cover's book, apparently, but didn't say anything about it.
Yeah. I just saw that for the first time today.
I really want to... One of the things I really want to talk about tonight is like kind of your memories of really 2 guys. We just talked about one, David Perkins and Ken Thomas, and kind of like how you met them. And kind of like what some of your like key memories of them are, and just how important really both of those guys like research really was to this whole community.
Yeah, I guess I'll start off with David because that's shorter. Chris O'Brien introduced us probably, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 years ago. Maybe it's not even that long. It seems like that long. And he said, I think you and David should talk. You'd have a lot to talk about. And we did. I went out and visited him. I called him a couple times, but then I went up to Santa Fe and visited him. And we had a nice talk. I don't think I recorded it. And then I visited him probably three or four more times. The thing that fascinated me about David is, one, as I just said, he didn't have a specific idea about cattle mutilations. He had one, but he wasn't married to it, which interested me because that means your mind is open to other things. And you can debate a little bit better because you're not backed into a corner about some theory that everybody associates you with and you make money off of or whatever the hell. Which he didn't. I mean, he wasn't making any money off the cattle mutilation thing. It was just something that interested him. He was one of the first mutilation researchers in the, I think, 75 or 76 is when he started, which is ridiculous because I was a little kid then and most people probably listening weren't born. But it was fascinating to talk to him about what those early days were like. What they were finding, some of the things that he saw, you know, just like from the ridiculous to the stomach churning to the everything in between you could think of with cattle mutilations. Both he and Chris actually praised Linda Howe for the way she went about things at the beginning and how she did her research on cattle mutilations. Chris said something in particular, and David totally agreed with it. A witness, especially a rancher, a male rancher, will speak to a woman way differently than they speak to a male investigator. And people don't really think about that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's extremely valuable, not only for any kind of paranormal investigation, but especially for this, where it's ranchers and it's Southwest and it's a macho culture and the whole thing. So, you know, a soft voice asking you questions about this extremely disturbing thing would elicit responses that people wouldn't normally get. And David said he learned a lot from her, and so did Chris. And I think he wrote a book really early on about this, about cattle mutilations. I'm going to be horribly embarrassed if I get it wrong. I think the name of the book was Altered Stakes.
Yep.
I'm right. Okay. Thank you.
I think you can see it in Adam's background. Actually, it's on.
Yeah, it's right behind me.
You have one.
Yeah. Go grab it, Adam. He gave us both a copy of the.
They never gave me one, and I visited him.
Sorry. Of the self-published.
We just asked. We did.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't know. Maybe he did. I've got so many books that I might have it, but I don't remember seeing it. I mean, I've seen it, but I don't remember seeing it. I don't remember seeing it on my bookshelf. So. Never got to read it. What's in it? I mean, is it just, when was it published? 77, 78, something like that?
I think it was later than that.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I think it's the
80s. Altered States would have come out, I think, like 81.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, that would make sense. I mean, I guess the film popularized the phrase.
It's a colloquium on the cattle mutilation question. Let me see if there is a date. Yeah, 1982.
Okay.
Pretty early, yeah.
And it's all like, you know, it's typewritten,
yep,
and stapled together.
And
it's,
yeah,
it's basically just like a bunch. It looks like it's like an interview or like a discussion,
yeah,
between the cattle mutilation researchers.
Okay. Oh, who's in there? David and Tom Adams and.
Yeah, it looks like that. It's someone named Izzy.
That's David.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess it's just a discussion between the two of them.
Okay.
Yeah, Tom Clark did the cover art, is what it says.
A Socratic dialogue.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there was a... The first one was by a police officer, Keith Wolverton, I think. What was the name of that book? It also had a great title. I can't remember because nobody was calling cattle mutilations that time. It was just an unexplained animal death. So they came up with their own vocabulary for it. It's called Mystery Stalks the Prairie. That's a really, really rare one. But as time went on, David developed this Gaia hypothesis because he was basically a hippie from the 1960s. So, he helped start a commune that still exists. And I think his house is still there, one of his houses. He had one in Santa Fe he was renting, and one that he owned in the San Luis Valley. I can't remember what the name of the commune was. It wasn't Crestone, that's the name of one of the towns. Anyway, and he went back and forth between those two places. So yeah, the last time I talked to him, he said, let's do a final interview, which I will post here fairly in the next few weeks. He didn't really say anything. There wasn't a revelation in there or anything. It was just kind of restating what he'd already said before, that there were no explanations, that the mutilations tended to cluster downstream from either nuclear facilities or nuclear dumps or something like that, which might have been a clue about something. Like I said, that the whole thing was he thought was the planet, the Gaia, taking care of an infection, just like your body does when it gets an infection, just by killing things or people or whatever, or getting rid of the cancer. So, but there's so many other things, and he acknowledged them, finding technology there, and Gabe Valdez found gas masks at one of them, and
Yeah, I've heard
so
that.
there's so many different things. And if you hook onto one of them and just say, oh, well, it was the government people, or it was some private or corporation, or it was aliens, or and you have with cattle mutilations, you have evidence for all those things, including unexplained things. I asked one of the scientists at Bigelow at the Skinwalker that was there, and they were doing research, and he said that they could not decide whether to look at it from kind of almost David's point of view, or I don't know what you call us, not a spiritual point of view, but more of a anecdotal point of view, or a data gathering point of view. And so they decided to use data, gather data, and all their instruments would not collect anything that was usable, or they would quit at the wrong time, or all the cameras that were at this, and this has been talked about, all the cameras that were one location all pointed in another direction when something was going on, or they looked like they'd been ripped off of their things, including the cables. There's so many things that went on there that just confound people that were looking at it.
The phenomenon does not want to be filmed.
No, it doesn't. And that self-negating thing is present in a lot of paranormal activity, but especially cattle mutilations, UFO stuff, abductions, all that, anything associated with UFO subject. Well, also cryptids. You can never get close to them. All you can get is kind of a blurry, somebody made a joke. It's like, well, Bigfoot must be blurry. I think it was Mitch Hedberg, who I can't stand, but he said Bigfoot must be a blurry creature because that's all people get pictures of. And I don't think that's it. I think it is more like it can't. You just can't. It will not conform to normal methods of proof. It just won't. And I don't know what that reason is, except that it seemed, as Blaise said, it seems to react to whatever is looking at it, and just like, and I don't think, for me, I don't think it's a conscious reaction, like, oh, I'm going to be out of focus, or we're not going to get closer. That's just the nature of it. Like, you try to take a picture of the sun, and all you get's a spot, or a bl it fills up the whole picture with like white light. But that's the nature of sunlight. And so that's what I think, sort of as an analogy about the cattle mutilation thing, Bigfoot, UFOs, cryptids. It's just, it is not, by its nature, it is not photographable. By its nature, it is not data. I mean, it's data rich, but the data doesn't make any sense. And I think it's because it's like we're using the wrong tools. We're using the tools of analysis and data and deduction and scientific method to figure something out that does not conform to a materialist viewpoint. Although I'm sure you guys have discussed this with your guests hundreds of times on your show.
Oh
Oh,
yeah,
yeah.
absolutely.
So
But
I'm
that's
not going
still,
over anything new.
We still love those
To answer
old
your question about David,
hubcap on a string photos, though.
the clearer they are, the more likely they are to be faked. In fact,
Yes.
when people see, I mean, I think Massimo Teodorani, the astrophysicist, I mentioned this to him, and he said, you know, it's the clearer the picture is, the less likely it is to be authentic picture.
Yeah.
And Earl Grey Anderson, who you should have on your show, he's a head of Southern California MUFON and a friend of mine. He echoed something that Carla Turner told me in the 90s, which was she said, I think the answer to this is going to lie in anomalous details. What Earl says, and he's talked to hundreds and hundreds of witnesses, is that the more believable the witness testimony is, or the more logical it is, the less he believes it. Like if they don't come up with something completely insane somewhere in the narrative, he's like, the story holds too well together. It holds what together too well. And I don't know if
Yeah.
I can, you know, I he tends to think, and I totally agree with him. It was nice to hear this from somebody that actually does investigation, that the nonsensical nature of it is kind of its authentication stamp.
It needs a little high strangeness thrown in.
Yeah, or we consider high strangeness, I think. You know, it's kind of my I kind of said what I really think about this in a lot of ways, that it does what it's going to do, the UFO thing, cryptids, whatever, and the meaning comes from our interaction with it. It has its own meaning. It may have no meaning, maybe an existential, you know, kind of thing. But when we interact with it, that's where the meaning comes in. That's where all of our mythology and all of our ideas about it and all that come from, our interaction. I don't think it comes from a thing itself. And that stimulus, whatever it is, reacting to us. I have a friend that's an anthropologist, and he said, do you know what happens in a lot of UFO cases in is mimicry. Bigfoot does this too. Meaning, you know, when you can't communicate with somebody or something or somebody in another language, you just start mimicking them, thinking maybe that'll be the way that you can communicate. So he told me that he thinks there's a lot of that going on that may be a key to it. I'm not so sure. I think the mimicry is just it. I said one time, I said, I think the UFO thing is when we get too close to it, a big mirror comes up in front of us. And
When
so,
I was actually talking about this
and I'll
with,
talk about Ken in a second.
oh
I'm fine.
I was just going to say that. I was talking about this with Steve Stockton last night because I went on his show. We were talking about kind of this co-creation stuff, and I made the kind of the joke that, why do they have to take forms that scare the shit out of us? And I wonder, is there a role for fear, the fear response in the kind of co-creation
Yeah, I mean, it's a
relationship?
very strong response.
Yeah, creates a lot of energy for sure.
Yeah, to they're opposites on the emotion wheel, love and fear. I mean,
Yeah.
they're both very strong, and they're both, if you and people have those two feelings about the UFO thing, especially if they're having some kind of contact. They're either very positive and think, you know, aliens are sending them love and positive vibes and helping them out and going to help this planet, or they're just terrified and scared out of their wits. Sometimes it changes from one to the other. I don't know, but those teams seem to be the main reactions. I mean, humor, maybe. I mean, I don't know. Sadness, but fear and love are probably the two strongest emotional reactions we can have to anything, and there's plenty of it in the UFO thing. Maybe not so
Yes.
much with Bigfoot, although I guess some researchers would beg to differ.
That makes sense to me. And I wonder too about some of this being having a shamanic initiation aspect. Fear being
Yeah.
a part of that as well.
Yeah, as we would call it. I don't know what
Right.
whatever the source of the UFO thing would call it. It's just a it, it's a you know it's a forced altered state, as you said, with a shamanic initiation. You
Yeah.
don't expect it, and suddenly it's there. Josh Cutchin, I think he said this, I was we both went to somewhere to see the eclipse last time, the full eclipse. I'm going this time too.
Where are you going to see the eclipse this time?
Texas.
Texas, okay.
Yes, southwestern Texas. But what he said was, when I went through the eclipse, the experience of having the sun blocked out, he said, that's the closest I think I've been to having a paranormal, like a UFO sighting or a paranormal experience. If you didn't know it was coming, you would
Oh
crap
yeah.
your pants.
Oh yeah. If people did, I mean, eclipses are seen as omens and
Yeah, of course. Of course it is, because such a powerful experience is fear. I mean, So yeah, if I didn't know it was coming, I would have thought I was going to die or it was the end of the world or whatever. I mean, if you don't, it's still just so awe-inspiring. I mean, it's almost like seeing a UFO.
You know, there's a conspiracy theory right now that's making its way around X, the former the artist formerly known as Twitter.
I'll still call it
And
Twitter, but yeah.
people are on there saying, because apparently, that in these places like where you're going, they're expecting a ton of people to flock to where the line of totality is. And they're telling like there's some public officials were putting out that, oh, you should have like 2 weeks of food available, and now you're seeing like people
What?
posting online and saying, what are they planning? Something is happening.
They know
And
that these have
there's
happened before,
another
right?
there's an
Like just a few
yeah
years
exactly
ago.
well yeah
Like,
there's another there's a but because people are coming and like public officials are worried about that, like you're gonna have so many people that they can't, you might not be able to go anywhere. They're telling people to like, have 2 weeks of food on hand or something. But
I suppose that makes sense. Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
where we're
So
going, we're allowing like a couple of days to leave
right. And
and
so
getting
there's
there
a
a couple of days beforehand.
but so there's a fear of there's still that fear there of like something like an eclipse. It's like
Yeah.
it's some like deep primal fear that we have. I'm not
I guess
this
some people do. I've never noticed anybody having a fear of it.
this time we're not Nashville was in this in the path of the totality last time in 2017, but now I think we're like I think we're still like 90% or 80%
Yeah, it's
totality
almost the
here.
same track. It's kind of where, oh no, it's not. It was going northwest to southeast. Now it's going southwest to
The
northeast. Yeah.
Southern Illinois would be the closest to here, so
It
right across from
I
Kentucky.
remember last time a really cool thing was the when the sunlight was coming through like a tree or something like that, the
All the shadows showed the,
project
yeah.
the shadows of all the little crescents. Yeah, that was so cool.
Yeah, the partial eclipse that was here earlier this year, I went out and took pictures of all those shadows. But yeah, just seeing the, did you guys see the total eclipse last time? You must have.
Yeah,
I did in
yeah. Oh
Okay.
yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
Yeah,
it was just,
we didn't have to go anywhere.
yeah, time just
Okay.
stands still and kind of, yeah, you feel something for sure.
Yeah.
Good lead into Ken, because that's the last time I saw him.
In
Oh, wow.
2017.
Yeah, he invited my wife and I out to St. Louis, and he found out there was a paddle wheel steamer chartered to watch the eclipse. So we got on a paddle wheel steamer on the Mississippi River, and the guy, as we were getting close to the eclipse time, he said, "Oh, it looks like it's clouding up south of us. We're just going to stop here." So he just pointed the boat into the current and just basically kept us in the middle of the Mississippi and stationary as the
That's
eclipse
cool.
came over. Yeah, so we were drinking mint juleps and watching the eclipse. And it
That's
was pretty amazing. I mean, I didn't take a picture of it. I didn't want to take a picture of it. You can see plenty, and anyone I would have taken would have sucked. What I wanted to see was just the, I just wanted to see the eclipse and experience it without any break in it. So I just, put my little, actually, when it goes behind, when it's in totality, you can take the glasses off, but it's just like the pictures of it do not do it justice, as you know.
Yeah.
No, they don't. Yeah,
So,
it was pretty awesome. It really was awesome to see that. I think I was in second grade the first whenever the last time there was like a full eclipse where I was, so
Oh, I've only seen that one. None came through California the entire time, at least I know of, that I've been alive, and I've lived in Southern California all my life. So there are a bunch of partials, but never a total eclipse. And I saw an annular eclipse in Albuquerque about Oh, 10 or 15 years ago with Travis Walton, actually.
Did you really?
Wow.
Yeah. My friend, it was a, her best, his girlfriend's best friend at the time. So we just all got in a car and went out to this like ranch area and just watched the sun get 90% covered. And I still have a picture somewhere of him. And then afterwards we went and had green chili and tortillas, and he talked to me about about people being assholes about him doing about his claims, and also some of the music he liked and stuff. It was a really nice time to just sit and talk to him, which was
Yeah,
nice.
he's an interesting guy. We had him on a few years ago, and I actually, we talked about, of course, what happened, but I actually got him to talk about. I was like, Travis, have you ever had any other paranormal related experience? It's not like a UFO thing. And he had like basically he had like a this experience where. He fell asleep and like the gas, I think the gas was on in the house and someone had left it on and he managed to like he had an out of body experience where he saw that and then woke himself up and was able to turn it off before anything bad could happen. It was
Oh,
something
okay.
like that. I have
I
it
was
recorded,
gonna say I didn't
of
hear
course,
about it.
but
Like I was thinking, oh, you know what? I do know that story. 'Cause I remember
yeah.
thinking, well, maybe he just smelled gas in his, you know, in his hypnagogic state. That's what it told him. But who knows?
Yeah, it was something
You
like that.
probably would have
It
said, I
was
didn't smell any gas. I just woke up.
an interesting it was interesting. I mean, because you find that with, of course, you find that with a lot of people that have those experiences that they've had other t quote unquote other types of experiences.
Yeah. I don't think I knew to ask him that question when I was with him, but somehow I guess I'd heard that story from him at some point.
Yeah.
But yeah. And Ken Thomas, he was on the boat. He found out through his job. It was a bunch of people at his job at the University of Missouri St. Louis, where he worked in the archive for like 30 something years.
Yeah.
And I met him in 99 or 2000, I think, at a UFO convention in Laughlin, the UFO Congress, where he was speaking. And Nick Redfern wanted to interview him, so Nick and I went up to his room and interviewed Ken, or Nick did, and I just talked to him. But I had met him a couple of years before, I think, at one of the UFO conventions out here in LA, and we talked a little bit, but we hadn't really kept in touch. But after Nick and I went and talked to him at Laughlin UFO Congress, then we kept in touch, and I don't think I ever wrote anything for Steam Shovel Press. Oh, I think I did, but it was just something that he had an interview or something he had done with one in Steam Shovel Press, which was what his magazine journal zine was called. And yeah, his first book was The Octopus that he wrote with Jim Keith, right?
Yep.
And I read that book before I met him. And then when after I met him, we talked about it quite a bit. He was also very heavily, of course, into the Kennedy assassination and RFK and MLK and things like that, and the connections between them. He wrote books about, he even wrote a book about Maury Island, the Maury Island UFO incident.
Good one, yeah.
Yeah, and with tons of research with things that, you know, I didn't know that that Harold Dahl's son, one of the witnesses, like he ran off for a while and disappeared right after it. Nobody knew where he was. And then he came back and he couldn't remember where he was or what he was doing. Another strange thing associated with something that some people say is a hoax, including one of the other witnesses. Not the, I can't remember if Crisman was a witness or he was just, no, he was a guy, he was Harold Dahl's like boss or something
Boss,
at the time.
he owned the ship or the boat,
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
But Ken had this idea that he was involved with the Kennedy assassination and thought he was one of the three tramps, which I doubted. But you know, it's some people think it's E. Howard Hunt or something, that one figure. But anyway, Ken and I went to his funeral actually a few months ago. I traveled out to St. Louis and went to his funeral. He's buried a stone's throw from William S. Burroughs' grave. A long stone's throw. I mean, you have to throw it pretty good.
Right.
But you can walk there in like less than 5 minutes. I did it. I walked after Ken's the ceremony at his gravesite. Everybody left and I walked over to Burroughs' gravesite. The last time I was there was when Ken showed it to me before the eclipse. But the main thing I can say about Ken is he went places, not physically, but he went places in his research that nobody had before, showed a lot of people the way, not a lot of people followed. He was sufficiently skeptical about things. He thought I was way too skeptical, but that's okay. We had good natured discussions about it all the time. He'd always say, Greg, you read too much of that skeptical literature. I was like, Dan, I'm just asking you questions. I'm not saying you're full of shit or anything. So he basically, I mean, I think for that period, for like the 90s through the 2000s, he was probably one of the best known and respected people in the conspiracy world. And you guys probably know. Did you guys ever have him on your show?
Oh yeah, we had him on twice. Yeah,
Yeah, okay.
I think because of you, you had suggested us to him, and he reached out to me,
No.
and I was vaguely familiar with him, and then I think I said something to Surfiel, and he was like, "Oh, that's one of the big conspiracy guys of all time." The Steve
Yeah.
Shovel Press, and we had him on about the Trump book that he did.
Oh yeah, Trumpocalypse.
And then we had him on about the octopus book, because that was a one that I'd always wanted to talk about on the show. And he was the
Yeah.
perfect. Yeah, I loved speaking with Ken. He was always like really awesome and pleasant to talk to, and
Yeah.
he had like so many stories of all these like conferences and conventions that, there was one funny story that you told me. I don't know. You may or may not want to repeat it, but he there was
I
something
will. He'd want us
about
to.
Your radio station.
Oh, him turning me into the FCC?
Yes, that was a funny story.
I was on a internet radio station called Kill Radio for a while, and actually, I was on a pirate station, a full-fledged FM
Right.
pirate station from '98 to about 2000, till the FCC busted it twice. And the second time they confiscated the equipment.
What was the range of it, Greg?
Or wattage.
Yeah, what was the
It
how?
was 40 watts. There is a the woman that ran it, Sue. She wrote a book called 40 Watts from Nowhere about our time there. And I'm listed in there as a I think space brother. I did a show on that station for a couple of years until the FCC busted them. And then I went to Kill Radio, an internet station that was 24-hour internet. And that was, 2001 or something when nobody had internet stations. I was on there
Right.
for about 7, 8 years, and then the station just it went down for a while for a couple of months, and I'd been very slowly putting together my bug out plan of being able to do this from my house. So I finally did it. But Kill Radio at some point, some of the people in Kill Radio wanted to broadcast the internet signal as a pirate station in LA. So we used the same frequency because it was open at the time, 104.7. That's the KBLT was the name of the pirate station that was an actual
Return
pirate
to the
station.
scene of a crime, is that what that is?
Yeah, well, there was another station called Pirate Cat Radio that had a really low wattage from Hollywood, and we used to be able to hear that too. And we'd step on each other because, LA has completely crap. 104.7 is now a station that you can't get anymore because somebody bought the license for the frequency. But they wanted to put Kill Radio on Pirate, and I said, you can put it on the roof of my building. And it's like a two-story building. Oh, the KBLT signal, you could hear it 30 miles away in Long Beach
Cool.
because it was up on a hill in Silver Lake. So it's line of sight.
Okay, well, that's not too bad. That's a pretty good range.
That's a great range for a pirate station.
Absolutely.
And when it was on, so I said, let's just put it on my roof. So we got some ladders, and they bought the equipment from somebody that built it, I think in Arizona. And the antenna has to be the length that the frequency is to send out that frequency. It's like, 104.7, 1.47 meters or something like that. And so we put guy wires up on the roof, which for a while made the roof leak. And I had the transmitter sitting basically about 2 feet away from where I'm sitting right now, and the wires going out the window and up to the roof to the antenna. And we just ran it 24/7, and I just rebroadcast the signal. Then every once in a while, I'd cut in to do my with permission, I'd cut in to do my own show. So I was doing pirate radio out of my living, well, actually my bedroom, my desk for a while. And then I had was working a night shift, and so we didn't want to get caught. The Kill Radio one, we didn't want to get caught, so that only broadcast Friday nights from like 5 or 6 o'clock to Monday mornings to like 5 or 6 o'clock, because we figured the FCC wasn't in their offices then. They were out for the weekend. And it was fine for about 3 or 4 months. I went to work because I was on a night shift, and when I got back and in the morning, Ken said, "Oh, the FCC came and left this letter." I was like, "What?" Or no, the FCC came and asked if this is where the station was, and I told him. He said, "I don't know," but he gave his my name and all that. It's like, Ken, you're a conspiracy researcher. You gave me up to the man. He said, "What am I supposed to do? You live here." So I gave him a slight amount of crap for it, but yeah, I still have the letter from the FCC, the cease and desist letter. I'm so proud of that thing.
So you
So,
just stopped after that?
well, they
That
said you must prove by, it was like a month and a half later, by this date, that you have a license and blah. It's like, of course we didn't have a license.
It's not like insurance, you could just go run and get it.
Yeah. The complaint came from Gardena, which is where the FCC office is located. So I think there was some inside thing going on there. I don't
Somebody
think anybody
was.
complained. It's just the FCC was just like, we don't like this. But
Does
yeah, I
that
got a.
stuff still exist, those pirate radio stations like
I
that?
think so, but it's really diminished because of the internet. Because you can get to far more people just by doing a podcast like you guys are doing. But they said, yeah, you have to prove to us by a certain date. And it was like a week and a half, 2 weeks later that you have a license. And we thought, well, screw it. They caught us anyway. So we just went on 24/7 until the actual last possible day. And the last 20 or 30 minutes of our broadcast ever, I went on and did a live show and just talked about why we did it and what we were doing, and told everybody thank you for listening. And I was probably talking to 100 people at that point, or maybe a couple hundred, whatever. But yeah, I think I recorded it actually, the very last broadcast for the K KB, I mean, sorry, the Kill Radio's FM station. I think I also did it at KBLT too. I did a goodbye on that one too, because we were being shut down.
Was
So,
that radio? Were you just? Was it Radio Misterioso then that you were playing on that, or was it called something else?
my first show was Hungry Ghost, because I was on in the middle of the night and has a Buddhist connotation.
Gotcha.
The first interview I did, I think, was with Scott Corrales. I did interviews. I did interviews in 98, 99 when I was on that pirate station. Usually I just played music, but every once in a while I'd just have people and interview them if they were up, because on the East Coast, it's like 5 or 6 in the morning and on when I was doing my show. So if I could get somebody up early enough, I'd do an interview with them. So I did a few. That's where I first started doing interviews, was on a pirate station, an FM pirate station in LA.
Do you have any of that stuff recorded?
Yeah, I made cassettes of it because that's the only way we could do
Nice.
it. So I still have probably 30 or 40 cassettes of my old KBLT show. And then I've got CDs of my shows and interviews on Kill Radio, which was a lot longer. That was like 7 or 8 years. So I still have those. I found one with Ann Druffel that I don't think has ever been ever. It was live at the time, but I don't think it's ever been broadcast. So I've been editing it down. It'd be just interesting to hear Ann Druffel talking, and then probably 2004 or five or something like that when she was still alive, obviously. UFO researcher from Southern California. I met her at a MUFON meeting. I said, "Can we do an interview?" And she said, "Okay." So we did one on my show. And I found the CDs a few months ago, and I've been, I digitized it now. There's noises and junk in it, so I'm trying to clean it out. But there's a
Yeah.
few lost interviews. To get back to Ken, a lot of people don't know this. He was best man at my wedding. I mean, we're good enough friends that I just asked him to be best man. And David Childress used some miles he had and flew Ken out here as a gift. I guess that was David's gift for my wedding gift was to fly Ken out so he'd be able to be our best man. I didn't talk to Ken much in the last maybe 6 months of his life. I think he was dealing with some health problems.
Yeah.
When I was there, I had to take him to dialysis a couple of times. I had to drive him to dialysis. Yeah, one time this diabetes got so bad they had to amputate part of his foot.
Yeah.
I don't
I
know,
heard
about eight or 9 months before he passed away. I talked to him when he was in the hospital. He was not happy. One time he called, he said, "This is it, Greg. I think I'm going to die here. I'm not going to talk to you ever again. You've been such a good friend, and I think this is it." And I said, "Ken, stop it. You're just pissed off and scared because you're in the hospital." And he called me the next day and he said, "I don't know what was going on. Must have been drugs they put me on or something, but I was paranoid." But he was fine after that. I sent him care packages at the hospital, and when I sent him food, they opened it up and stole all the food. Somebody did.
sucks.
Yeah, I sent him books and magazines and candy and stuff like that. But yeah, the second time when I sent him, actually, because the hospital food was terrible, so I was trying to smuggle him in good food. But
Right.
it got opened and cleaned out, and then he got some books with food stains on them.
Was your zine around at the same time as the height of steam shovel press? I'm just
Yeah.
kind of want some insight into what the interaction of more the UFO world and the conspiracy world at that time was like.
Yeah, sorry, I realize I've been wandering, but Ken, when he was doing Steam Shovel Press, he had started it, I think, in the early 90s. Excluded Middle started in 90, late 91, early 92. So we were concurrently publishing. He
Yeah.
actually gave me pointers about like printers and how he did layouts and all that stuff. We discussed that quite a bit afterwards. Yeah, they were concurrent. We were sort of mining the same stuff. He would have UFO stuff in his magazine, and I would have conspiracy stuff in mine. I mean, we there was a lot of crossover. It wasn't just a UFO magazine, and Ken's wasn't just a conspiracy magazine. It was basically any weirdness, you know. Did I think Ken had an interview that he had done with Leary, with Timothy Leary, somewhere in there? Ken also lent me. Here's a crossover. He did an interview with John Keel sometime in the 90s on a, when he was on college radio, and he lent me that or gave me that recording. And I had it up on Radio Mysterio, so it might still be there. One of the few recordings of, I mean, I'm sure there's others, but one of the few recordings of Keel doing an interview. In fact, the beginning of my show where Keel says, "I don't think, the beginning of Radio Mysterio. The extraterrestrial hypothesis is not a good explanation for this." That's from Ken's interview with John Keel.
Is it?
Yeah,
Okay.
yeah,
Cool. I wondered where that actually came from. Yeah.
yeah. That's Ken's interview with John Keel, which I mean, if you go to Mario Mysterio, so I think if you go way down the list or search for it, it's probably still there. If not, I'll re-upload it. But
Okay.
that's a rare interview, and it was a good one too because Ken was. Ken was a really good radio person. I think way better than I ever was. He had a good voice for it. He had a good attitude. He had a really good way of asking questions. So that's probably another reason why he was a really good researcher, being able to talk to people and get information out of them that normally you wouldn't. And some of his friends, like oh, who was the guy? Not Sherman Skolnick. I think he knew him. Who's the guy in Washington, D.C.? I can't remember his name. Anyway, you probably know who he is.
I mean, we talked about, I remember when I had Ken on, he talked about meeting people like Fletcher Prouty, and he knew Dick Gregory was somebody that he
He was
well
friends
had.
with Gregory, I think.
Yeah.
And enough that he could talk to him when, and he'd done some interviews with him. And also, well, Gregory was into the Kennedy assassination. I think that's
Oh
why
yeah,
he and
right.
Ken were. And I think Ken probably met him at one of the JFK assassination conventions in Dallas that they would have every
Yeah.
year.
Well, whenever they first showed the Zapruder film on the Geraldo show, Dick Gregory was there.
Oh, okay.
It's one of the three, and I think one of the researchers who assassination researchers who worked on the Zapruder film stuff.
Okay, I'm so far removed from conspiracy stuff right now that
Well,
it's kind of hard for me to remember these things, mainly
yeah.
because the conspiracy thing has gotten a bad name in the last few years, obviously.
Yeah, and that's
Ken
something that Ken
lamented it
talked.
too. Yeah.
Yeah, especially when he was talking about when he was promoting that Trumpocalypse book, and he really painted the picture for us of
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-hour energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
The really diverse and politically crossed over world of 80s and 90s conspiracy theory, when that was really at a head, and that also crossed over into UFOs and all this other stuff. But yeah, real
Yeah,
real
it's
interesting
this,
guy.
this apotheosis of conspiracy culture was something that, I mean, Ken lamented it. Rob Sterling, who you've probably had on your show, it really bothered him too. It's just kind of like you've taken all this research and this critical thought into something that's very important and just turned it into a political bandwagon, or at least a platform for blind belief. And they absolutely were against that kind of thing. Ken, I know, was. He would change his opinion if he got new information. He was not wedded to any theory, like we were saying about David. This is why Ken was a real good friend of mine. That
Well,
critical thought with conspiracies has gone out the window.
oh, it absolutely has.
You know, and it's one place where it's needed.
Wasn't Miles Lewis, wasn't he interviewed for some article
Yes, he
about
was.
that? Yeah.
I just spent a week with him in the Eastern Sierra, just hanging out with him and my friend Robert, who was one of the co-founders of Excluded Middle. So I got to talk to Miles quite a bit, and he told me about that interview and what had happened. And he said that it was a researcher that was doing research on conspiracy culture for, I think, a university or for a doctorate or something like that, and she had connections at the New York Times, and they asked her to do an article on it. And Miles just kind of floated to the top as the person she wanted to profile, because he had, just like we were talking about here, he had gone through this. What has happened to my beautiful conspiracy culture?
Well, I feel the same way, Greg, so.
Miles became kind of the touchstone of that, because she was talking it. Basically, she asked, I was in the article too for a little bit. I talked to her for like 2 hours. But the main point of that was, what we've just been saying. It's like we used to, or they used to, I wasn't really a conspiracy researcher so much, look for, absolute sources, make educated guesses, and try and follow the trail and the evidence where it led. And not have your theory lead the evidence. But I think that's, as you've said, both of you, I think, is that that's changed completely now. It's mostly whatever my belief is, let me find the evidence to back it up. No matter what that might be, or how dangerous that might be, or how wrong it is, or, and I think this is what Ken was the most upset about, is how the information is used to scare and hurt people. That's what he was really worried about. And I think Miles is, and Robert is, and all these people that were conspiracy people in the 90s, 80s, 90s, whatever, early 2000s. It's a political tool now, where before it was a questioning of authority, which is, people think they're questioning authority now, but it's basically authorities are feeding them fears, and then
Yeah.
it becomes a loop.
It's
So
become a propaganda tool,
yeah, conspiracies is now
essentially.
propaganda. I'm sure that's what Ken said in his interview with you.
I would say though that though the methods now are usually much less scholarly to, for sure.
Yeah, for
No,
everything, really. So the
yeah.
conspiracy thing just follows it.
Yeah, everything else, but the those kind of extremist political projects were definitely always there, but it just seems to have been I think they were interested too in courting the other side, and so you had people like say like the LaRouche people who, you wouldn't really be able to tell that these weren't even kind of run-of-the-mill leftists until you really start digging in, and then you're like, oh, you guys are like some weird cult, or a lot of other kind
Yeah.
of propaganda projects. But it was an environment that was a lot more diverse, this kind of conspiracy world,
Yeah.
just in general.
That place where far left and far right meet is that's you see it now. I mean, there's total far right wing people with really strange ideas that match up with people that are in the New Age movement. And it to me, it's like that's mind-boggling to me, but it makes sense. I mean, it's always been that way. It's just that it's become
Yeah.
more common now.
I think it's
It
hard for us to
screams of
have kind
belief.
of that. It's harder to have that kind of Discordian, playful distance from things like I
Yeah.
think we might have, used to
It
have been
is.
afforded. And now everything's just too real and too ugly. And these things that you used to, have fun, kind of have fun with that seem to have less consequence now are just really, really nasty.
Yeah, you can't have that distance from it, because whatever you say, you're gonna be tarred with some brush
Right.
by somebody. And at the time in the 90s, when I like kind of got into this, the brush was you're a crazy conspiracy theorist, or you're a crazy UFO researcher, or you're a crazy Bigfoot believer, or whatever. And now that's kind of like it's almost normal.
Yeah.
And I think I said this to Miguel once. I said, I wish UFOs would just go back to being no, not nobody cares about it. It's no big deal. It's just not a subject anybody really discusses or bases any, spends a lot of time with. And it's not because you said, oh, you want to be a hipster. I was like, no, it has nothing to do with that. I think the more attention that's paid to it, the less, I don't know about authentic, but the less variety we get out of it. You know what I mean? Because whenever anything's codified, I mean, it's like it's a band you really like, suddenly a lot of people start listening to them. So they conform to what people want, or that thing that everybody likes, and they lose their originality. They just become that act. And I feel like the UFO thing has become an act. It's just been like, what does the government know about aliens, and are they going to tell us about it? And everything else has been, for most of the public, everything's been sucked into that, for the most part. But there are people. So funny, I've been seeing things online now where people are reading Mac Tony's books. Like, oh my God, have you seen this? It's like, yeah, the book's like 10 years old.
It's like
But
it's
it,
completely new to them.
yeah, but the thing is, of course, I could say, well, you didn't know that. It's like, I've just been looking at this, and my friends have been looking at this for a long time. I'm glad people are looking at those things and seeing those things and talking about, alternatives to the extraterrestrial hypothesis. In fact, somebody on one of the lists the other day said, I'm going to say something really weird. I'm going to say that maybe there is something to the ETH, because so many people were talking away from it. So it almost became radical to go back to it in a very short time, which is actually kind of refreshing. I like that back and forth. I like the craziness, and I don't often participate. I don't engage, because it's just, I mean, I'll say something and then I'll just feel like, oh God, I shouldn't have said that, because people immediately get upset. Or, I mean, it's the internet, it's That sea lioning thing. Do you know about that?
The what?
I did not know about this term until recently. There's a cartoon where this it's these two people are talking, and one person says, "Well, you know, I like most animals, but I can't really couldn't do could do without sea lions." And her friend says, "Oh my God, you shouldn't have said that. Now you've done it." And a sea lion shows up. He says, "I couldn't help but notice you were saying something bad about sea lions."
Right.
And
Yeah.
the sea lion just won't let her alone after that. It's like,
Yeah.
so were you have do you have any data to back up this opinion, this negative opinion about sea lions? Then it shows up at breakfast, it shows up at her bedroom. She's like, "I'm trying to sleep." All right, we will continue in an hour. It's like that's
So
basically what's going on.
that's
The
pretty much
internet.
a that's pretty much a internet discourse.
So it has a name now, sea lining.
Let me ask you this. Let me ask you this, Greg. Kind of turn into a well, you were just
I
talking
promise I didn't
about
have any coffee before the show.
you just talk about how UFOs like it's too famous. Wish it would kind of retreat. But I guess that being said, that since let's just say 2017, with all the To the Stars Academy and all that stuff started happening, and the big revelations in the New York Times and all this. Has there been anything since then that you would say that stands out to you? Or is it still just kind of all just a big mess?
The
Is
thing
there
that
any
stands out,
movement forward in the last few years?
you know what the movement forward is, and how I kind of aligned myself was with academics. I almost had the idea to go back and get a PhD in art history, which is what my only degree, to deal with this issue. And the good thing about all this, I can complain, I wish nobody paid attention. This is my thing and my friends. It's like, no. The good thing about this is it's made it okay for people with credentials to be interested. Whereas before they had to hide it.
Yeah.
And so that's a really good upshot of it. I mean, there's also the Velikovsky thing of not Velikovsky, the Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Who was that? Hume, that said that science changes by slow evolution or or very slowly or very quickly. And the way it changes slowly is by, a whole bunch of people finding different information. The second way it changes slowly is all the people that were promoting the old information die off, which I think is what's going on now. And the third way is some incredible discovery that nobody can deny. That scientists have to change all of their thinking and all their theories, or at least modify them to accommodate the new information. And I think for UFOs, it's just the fact that whatever you think of Elizondo and the New York Times article and, To the Stars, like you mentioned, all that, it has made it okay for credentialed people who are very circumspect about what they do to discuss this. And so I think, some of the most interesting things have come out of, from academics like Kripal, who was doing this beforehand.
Right, yeah, I was
Diana,
about
of
to say,
course.
Kripal's been doing it for a while,
Well, he's an exception,
yeah.
Diana Pasulka or Stephen Finley or people like that, or Mike Masters. That it's been okay for them to talk about this, and of course, they're all under 40, or I think near it, or far enough, but close enough to it that that's a different generation. The ones that were like, we're not going to talk about that. We're not going to, The AARO report, the one from the official report that came out, to me, that's like an old guard report. And people are really unhappy with it because it says, the same thing the government's been saying for a long time, in essence, that we don't have any information, we don't have any information or data or proof that this is anything extraterrestrial. It could be, but we don't have enough proof now. And I kind of agree with that, but in the details, the details are very, almost like that old, I'm afraid to even look at this because it's going to have, it'd be too much of a pain in the butt to change everything. But like I said, the upshot is that I think that new ideas have come and will come from academia, not from UFO researchers. I think about 10 years ago, I said, I wish people with degrees would look at this, because then nobody will pay any attention to you without ufologists anymore. And I think that's still happening. I think we're in the middle of that. Or at least they'll have to share the stage with people with degrees and from colleges and universities and all that, which is fine. They're not really sharing the stage. I mean, they're having separate. I've been to both conferences. And to me, the academic conferences are far more interesting than the regular ufology conferences. It's
Yeah,
just,
so
I hear new things there that I have not heard before.
you went to the RISE conference, right?
Yeah, the
Yeah.
first one and the second one.
Yeah, what was your thoughts on it? I mean, it was it
The Archives of
and I
the
wish I could see
Impossible
some of these
conference, yeah.
presentations, but
You
like,
can.
yeah, they're on
yeah.
YouTube.
Oh, they are?
They're
Okay.
all online, yeah. I even got
I
to
thought they
talk for
were
10
still.
minutes
Yeah, I heard about
at the
that.
first one. I mean, I was on a panel with people and they said, if there's anything you want to talk about, please bring it up. It's like, yes, there is something I want to talk about. So I talked about the ufology tarot. I thought that those conferences were basically the opening shot of academia is interested in this and is going to pursue it. And yes, it's the Archives of the Impossible, and they're talking about keeping all these records and papers and letters, things like that from different UFO researchers. I mean, it started with Vallée saying he was going to donate his archives to the his papers to the archive when he's gone. But also quickly followed by Whitley Strieber and some of the remote viewing people. They all started putting stuff in there, and I think that the fact that they take it seriously enough to be able to want to say that these artifacts and these documents are important is the significance behind this. And then everything else follows from that. I mean, all the presentations there, I thought were, I mean, any one of them would, to me, would be outstanding at a regular UFO conference, and they're all at that one conference. And the same with the second one. Just all it's one of, you go to a UFO conference, you go, okay, I can see that. Okay, I can miss that. I couldn't miss anything. I sat through the entire both days, both times. SALT conference too recently. It was all, whether I agreed or understood or not, it was vitally interesting to me to see all these scientists and some government people talking about the subject in a different way that's been talked than been has been discussed before. One of the best things I heard at the SOL conference, and it was from Valais, and people have probably seen this. There was a guy up there talking about the Schumer Amendment, the one that basically got defeated, about UFO openness by the government. And he said, this was before it was defeated. And the guy was saying, well, we're going to have, all these records, and we're going to keep very good records, and we're going to take information from military people. And Valais stood up and he said, are you taking any information from UFO witnesses and abductions and things like that? Because if you're not, you're missing probably way more than half or a great deal, three quarters of the data you could be gathering. Because they hadn't said, well, just regular people that have experiences, weren't, they didn't say anything about including that. And he says, well, you have to include that because then you're only getting part of the picture. And I thought was a, I thought that was the greatest point made during the whole the whole 2 days of that conference. You can't trust the government to have most people's interest in mind. It's such a weird thing because supposedly the government's for the people, but especially with some controversy like this that's so hooked in with intelligence and defense. It's just they're so married you can't pull them apart. So if you're looking to the government for all your answers, you're basically getting you're getting only part of the story. And so the whole story has to come from private research and from witnesses themselves. That data has to be entered. And then he said, what I'm going to concentrate on now is all the weirdest stuff and the stuff that people don't want to concentrate on, that people don't want to talk about. I think that's where the answer lies. There's that statement again.
Does
So, go
conversely,
ahead.
does anything worry you about the embracing of the subject by academia? Or, I mean, obviously there's those problems with it being embraced by government.
Yeah.
But maybe some kind of perspectives being lost, or just almost like what we were talking about earlier with this octopus documentary that for some reason we don't really know why does not, mention Ken Thomas at all, even though they show his book and go to his archive that they just refer to as an
Yeah.
archive there in St. Louis. But is
Yeah,
there
he donated
something that you
to the
think might get
university where he
lost
worked.
in translation from academia embracing this, and something they can maybe do to keep some kind of connection to the previous non-academic research?
I think the humanities and the arts and even something like a non-hard science, I suppose, like sociology, I don't think they're going to have any problem, because even though once in a while I'll see a paper or something, it's like, my God, this was discussed extensively in the 70s. What are you doing? Once they start doing more of a literature review, they'll get a little bit of better idea of the history, what has gone on before, what people have found out before. And there's a huge treasure trove of stuff there. It's just not presented as, a paper with an abstract that was published in a scientific journal. And I think a lot of these people I've talked to realize that. They realize that a lot of this information, good information, important information, is going to come from private researchers that with all the problems and issues and agendas that come along with that. But you have to really do a literature review and really find out what has gone on before you start going forward and then basically repeating somebody else's hard work that occurred, 10, 20, 30, 40 years before you. I think that's the greatest challenge. The other one is, and Diana points this out in her book, in her first book in American Cosmic, researchers, academic researchers, are used to people being to the free flow of information, supposedly. They share their sources. They share, it's like, where did you get this idea? Well, I got it from this one. There's citations in the work. But I think that they, because of that background, some of them may trust UFO researchers and people with an agenda a little bit too much. Because they think they're being straight with them. And sometimes they're not. I mean, they're not talking to academics. They're talking to regular people. Some are smart, some are dumb, some are charlatans, some aren't. And sometimes I see that filter not working too well with academics because their sphere is free flow of information. And outside of that sphere, it's not really. Especially the UFO stuff or anything that gets people excited or has a history like ufology does. So yeah, that discernment I think will come. And I see it developing in the people that I talk to, which is good. I've actually helped them with it. It's like, this person's good. It's like, oh, that person's actually kind of wacko. And it's good as a sociology experiment, but for real information, no, probably not a good idea. Just stuff like that. And like I said, it's developing, and I think that's wonderful. But
Yeah,
yeah, that would
absolutely.
be my biggest fear is like kind of either being too trusting or conversely ivory towering it and not really paying attention, like you said at the beginning, not really going to doing the literature review of stuff that's come before. But that's going to be in anything. It's going to be in any intellectual pursuit's going to have those problems. So, but the upshot is it's great that they're looking at this stuff. I mean, the conversations I had
It's fantastic.
At those
Great.
conferences were so information rich and so interesting to me.
Yeah.
As opposed to going and having somebody tell me, which star system they think so and so is coming from. It's like,
Well,
okay, I've heard that about 8,000 times. I'd like to hear something new for me. Right.
it's good that as academics, and especially as religious studies
Yeah.
academics, that they are taking it seriously, because one of the things that I've thought about this since I've been studying it is that it's just another form of religious experience, and so that the fact that they're beginning to take something like that seriously. I mean, if you look at something like Betty Andreasen and her experience, I mean, it's very religious, has a lot of religious overtones, but that's just one example. And I think what you're seeing is just another form of maybe a kind of particularly American form of religious experience, but it
Yeah,
is
of
religious
belief. Yeah.
experience nonetheless.
Well, the whole UFO thing up to this point has been mostly belief.
Right.
A lot of the information has flowed from belief, and then any information we get from that is, which is why, APRO and QFOs and all, and MUFON to some extent, all they want to collect data without that in content in it. But unfortunately, conversely, it should be in there.
MUFON is fine with super soldiers from Mars talking about blue avians, though. They are fine about
Yeah, a couple of years ago at their conference. I
that.
don't know. I don't know what's going on with MUFON right now. Like I said, I have friends in there, and the rank and file. I gave a lecture at MUFON, like, well, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago, Orange County MUFON, and I got a letter from the organizer later saying, we were insulted by your talk, saying that people were making things up. And I was like, I didn't say anything at the time of the kind. I said that we have to realize what people's perceptions are and to factor that into the
Yeah.
equation. I
Talk
didn't
about
say
a
people weren't seeing things or that UFOs
right.
were not. I was like, what? But I
Talk
went
about a
out,
religion.
I went out to dinner with the people that were there talking, seeing the lecture. They got it. They totally got
Right.
it.
Well,
So I don't, I used to say get rid of MUFON, and I, maybe get rid of the MUFON, maybe some of the people that run it, I don't know, but I think it still provides a service for people that have nowhere else to go,
yeah.
that are either interested in this or they've had an experience, they need some sort of validation that somebody else has had this experience in a group, in a kind of a safe group where they can talk about this. And that in its, apart from all the politics and what's his name getting arrested and John Ventry being a racist and all that, for these people, it's still useful. And it's unfortunate in a lot of ways, but it's all they have. And so I've kind of backed off and being so nasty about MUFON. It needs to be there. People need that nexus of social structure to be able to discuss this in a way that helps them out. If for some people, it's the only way they have to kind of process what's happened to them. And that's, if for nothing else, that's what it should exist for. Apart from all the other stuff and gathering the data and all that stuff and doing TV shows or whatever the hell else they do. And there's good people there. I have friends in there that are totally down with what we've been talking about here, and they don't care about the ETH, or they think it's just one of many ideas. And that's not the official MUFON party line.
What do you think about Dave Grusch?
Was that in your list of questions? A lot of people have been comparing him to Paul Benowitz, and I don't think that's a fair comparison. I think if you wanted to make a comparison, it'd probably be more like no, I was trying to, a Bob Lazar to me. He's kind of a very developed Bob Lazar, where Lazar, I think, saw things and was shown things and was allowed to say things. Otherwise, we would not have heard about him. People keep saying, oh, you got all this information out. It's like, no, he was supposed to, for I don't know what reason, but it was a military industrial defense hardware, et cetera, reason. Not aliens are here and we're developing, whatever. We're back engineering their technology. And to me, I think Grush is kind of the same thing. Somebody somewhere about around 2017 or a few years before that, I would factor Bigelow and his people into this equation too. Somebody somewhere in the government or some group of people wanted to use the UFO subject for something, for as a fulcrum for doing something else. And so they just said, well, let's just tickle this a little bit and see what happens. And it I'm pretty sure it has to do with technology and intelligence and counterintelligence and new technology being developed and ways to find out who else has that technology and how they're using it or how they're using it against us. Who knows? I pointed this out on Tim Banal's show a few weeks ago. I have a friend that works in Los Alamos, And she said, "Do you want a job?" I said, "What are you talking about?" She goes, "Los Alamos is hiring like mad." I said, "Why?" She said, "Because it's a nuclear arms race on with China right now, and they're building nuclear bombs like nobody's business." I said,
I remember
"What?"
listening. Yeah, that's not scary at all, is it?
Yeah, and I said, very strange that all this UFO stuff comes up right around this. I mean, that's my conspiracy mind thinking.
Yeah.
But, long time ago, Bill Moore told me this. I was complaining about UFO people, and he said they always think it's about them. Meaning, if some information about UFOs comes from the government, they think, well, they're finally going to tell us about UFOs. This is what we've been waiting for, and almost assuredly, it has nothing to do with UFO researchers or revealing anything. It has to do with some kind of project or some kind of intelligence thing that's being run, or some way of pulling information or seeing what people know. Or, I mean, I'm sorry, my everything looks like a nail to me because of Project Beta, but it just seems to me like these are all the same earmarks. So I think Grush is sincere, just like I think Bob Lazar was sincere. But I also think that I'll tell you what happened. When I saw when he did the testimony, I was watching and I said, "Oh my God, this is a UFO convention in Congress." That's basically what it was. It's like Bill Cooper getting up and saying, "Somebody told me that the government has these things, and and they showed me the documents and this and that." It's like, okay, that's real exciting, Bill, but we're not going to be able to see it. And whoever showed it to you is just, who knows if it's real or not? I don't know. Did they show you a UFO? I mean, Grush said he talked to people who saw this. He didn't say he saw it himself,
Right. Yeah,
as
that was
far
all
as I know.
that. Yes, that's exactly what he says. And he
So
still
it's a
says,
UFO convention for Congress.
I've definitely talked to people who say they saw shit.
But that was the thing. It's just like whenever he came out and people were like raving about him, and they said that they had found, this insider that had all this insider information. And then I see the footage where he says, "Well, I talked to people that have seen them." Well, no, like you don't have any real firsthand information, and you could be just being fed disinformation. And he very much is like, he just seems like a spook to me, just the way he acts and just how he is, and
I
just
guess. I mean, he's apparently he has like real low level to autism or something like
he
that.
does. You can't fault him for that, but he's very cagey, and just, I don't think those guys really, if they leave those agencies, they don't leave that mentality, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, that, and I think, if you give him complete benefit of the doubt, he's saying things that he saw because somebody said it's okay to talk about it. That's all. But they only said it was okay to talk about it because it's useful to someone or some group of people or whatever. And if that's the case, I still have this prediction that I had at the beginning, almost at right after New York Times article. When whatever is th this is for is finished, government won't be talking about UFOs anymore. UFO researchers will be like, "Hey, how come they didn't say it? It's a cover up again. What's going on? They're not talking about it anymore." It's like, well, because they don't need to. Whatever they were using it for is finished. It either worked or it didn't, or it kind
If
of
the
worked or
ship really
whatever.
goes down with China or Russia, we better hope those little fucking Tic Tacs do their job.
Yeah. Well, who knows? Who knows what's going on? That's the whatever these things are. I think they're probably kind of like a, and everybody, it's not an original idea, but if any of this stuff is quote unquote real in some way, it's one of those things where we're not going to talk about it until it's actually used. And when it is used, you won't even know what it is because it'll be so far outside of your understanding. You just it, you, either it won't register or you'll think it's a solar eclipse or whatever.
There's the solar eclipse conspiracy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, well, the reaction to it, just like somebody, like talk about shock and awe, just something going on where you just cannot process it. And right at that point, all your stuff's being bombed. That kind of thing. So who knows? Who knows what's there, what's behind this, whatever. I mean, it may just be trying to see what people think about it now. I don't know. But it's not one thing, it's a bunch of things happening at once.
Sure,
And
absolutely.
Yeah, whenever the intelligence community decides to move in a direction, they're not doing one thing, they're doing like 30 things or whatever. And I think they're really good at it. And they've had what, 50, 60 years of information about UFO researchers, rumors, how it goes through the room, how people talk to each other, who knows each other. It's another thing. I see people online just saying, "What do you think of this?" And it's some hot button topic. I never answer that because I don't want people to, I mean, they know anyway, but why make it easy? I don't want people to know who I know, what I know, what makes me excited, what I'm pissed off about, whatever. Because the best way to get somebody to believe whatever it is they're trying to shove at you is to appeal to your emotions and either scare you or make you love something, or scare you with something that will make you react the way they want you to react, or show you something that you're very strongly for so that you're for it and associate whatever it is they want you to be for with it. So I think, in light of that, I think people should keep their own counsel, really, especially online about stuff. I've really stopped saying a lot online. I still will say something once in a while to my, I probably shouldn't, but every once in a while, I'll just say, "Well, this happened like 30 years ago in the exact same way." And then either people are interested or they get mad at me. So, or they don't understand and I have to explain it. And it's just kind of like, it's just because I've been in it for so long, I've got very specific, weird ideas, just like anybody that's been into this for a while. Conspiracies, too, obviously.
Isn't that
Yeah.
one of your famous things that do not engage?
Yeah. Yeah, I had too many places where I stuck my neck out by showing my either something I'm interested in or my ignorance or whatever, and then just having somebody come and chop my head off right away. It's like, well, you know what? The internet is not made for reasoned debate. It's basically a cage match, and everybody knows everybody is watching, and you don't want to lose. Like, oh, well, everybody saw me get beaten by this person. It's like, that's not an exchange of information or free ideas. That's basically a public fight.
What's the word, Sir Field? Net bangers? Is that a good word
Yeah.
for that?
Yeah.
Well, Greg, the time we've got left, you are going to be actually doing our first online event here coming up, and we should say that that is going to be coming up on April 24th. So
Okay.
let's talk a little bit about what you're going to be talking about at that.
At the beginning, you said, "What am I going to talk about?" And I said, "Oh, probably more about the UFOs and the creative thing and the art and all that." And then I thought, "Wait a minute! I've been assigned for a long-term project to research UFO. I'm sorry, alien writing, something I've been interested in for a long time. Beginning with my meeting Mario Pozzaglini, Dr. Mario Pozzaglini, in 1997 or so." He was a clinical psychologist, and he studied what he called received scripts, any kind of non-human or non-human appearing language that was either seen, remembered, channeled by some external source, trying to communicate something in something we know as writing. And the history of the UFO subject is full of those things. I don't think anybody's ever proven that it's actually some alien's language. My idea is it's more like if it is, if there are true, quote unquote, alien languages, that they are probably more co-creative. Like the person that is using it or seeing it or whatever has been inspired to do it as a reaction to their experience. And even though they will say the aliens gave me this or angels told me this or whatever, it's their way of being able to figure out what happened and put some sort of sense into it. And in the middle of that is who knows? Who knows what's coming through? Hardly any of them have been translated, and usually people that have these experiences and say they have alien writing, they say this is not a literal language. It's trying to communicate ideas in a way that's different than language, and the letters or the symbols or whatever are affecting the way you think about things. They're not to be read as A, B, C, D, E. They're to be read as something, almost as a object of meditation. And the message comes through just by looking at the shapes and the figures. I think that's what a lot of people have said about their received writing. Although some have said, no, this is the aliens writing and this, you know, it's how to fly the ship or whatever. And I wanted to talk about authentic as opposed to non-authentic, and the authentic tends to be things that don't have a one-to-one relationship with the subject's native language. Like there was a book written, published in the 1930s, From India to the Planet Mars. Have you heard about that one?
No.
A French researcher found this woman who was saying that she was getting messages from, I guess, from some disembodied spirit. But then it turned out later, she said, no, these people are from Mars. And this is the Martian language that they are showing me. And when it was analyzed, it had a one-to-one relationship with French, because that was her native language. And so the letters were A, B, C, D, E, F, G. But, you know, they were just written. They were just like weird symbols and things. But they each had, like, they were, you know, 27 or 26 or 28 letters or whatever. And all the words were formed by those things, even though they might be weird words that we wouldn't think of. But there's others where, like I said, people just say you can't translate it. It's to communicate an idea or a concept, not literally like we are talking right now. It's more like if you look at a piece of art and you get a message from it that is communicated to you non-verbally, that is more like what some people say their alien writing is about, or their communications through this writing. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
it does. Yeah.
So anyway, that's what I think I want to talk about. And it does kind of work into my UFOs as a cosmic art project thing in the way that I just explained to you, where some of these languages are communicating on a nonverbal level, or a non, you know, in a symbolic level that bypasses your conscious awareness.
Awesome. So, well, we really look forward to that. And I'm sure the audience will as well. Again, everybody, that's April 24th.
Yeah, and we will let you know what time that will be as we get a little closer. Just stay tuned for like any announcements about that on the podcast feed or YouTube channel. So that is really, really cool to have you on board and have you start the year. We're glad to be kind of getting back in gear with that. We haven't done it in a few months, so since right before the conference. So it's been a little while. So.
Yeah, thank you for asking me about it, because I was thinking of more things to talk about, and, you know, changing the talk as I was talking to you, because it's sort of notes now. It's not really a talk yet, but it will be when you guys see it.
Fresh material. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, I talked to you about that last year, but after the conference, I was just like really tired. But so we're getting started with you this year, Greg. So thank you for doing that with us.
Sure. No problem. Cool. I will enjoy it. Any chance to do, and you guys are the same way, any chance to do research on something that I wouldn't normally have when I've got outside pressure to do it is welcomed. So thank you.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, it's been awesome having you, Greg. I want to thank you for coming on and being a part of the show tonight. Where can people find you? And tell them about the books that you have available as well.
Well, there's a few. Wake Up Down There, which is a collection of my magazine, or our magazine. My friends Peter and Robert put it together with me in the 90s. Project Beta was after that, which everybody knows about. Weird California, I wrote about 75% of that. That's still available in print. Just weird stuff in California, which is almost redundant. A is for Adamski, co-written with Adam Gorightly, about the contactee movement, or contactees from almost the beginning up to now. And It Defies Language, that's the collection of stuff I wrote online, plus some extras. And of course, the Ufology Tarot project that we just finished about a year ago. So that's pretty much what's going on now. And I'm moving ahead. I'm going to do the alien writing thing for you. And I'm working on a book based on about 200 pages of notes I've been collecting for like the last 5 or 6 years.
Okay, well, excellent. Thank you so much, Greg. And guys, stay tuned. We're working on a announcement about the Strange Realities Conference as well. So stay tuned as we kind of finalize plans for that. But if you guys want to hear us, of course, if you're catching us for the first time, Conspiranormal, it's on every platform you could possibly find, and also on YouTube. And we have a Patreon as well with some extra content on there. And if you want to support us, Serfio can tell you where to find that.
You can go over to patreon.com/conspiranormal for everyone on there who joins the Mystic crew that gets you into these streaming monthly presentations. And there is quite a catalog of those up there as well that you can check out that we did in the past at that tier level. That's patreon.com/conspiranormal.
All right, guys, I want to thank you for listening, and we will be back in a couple of weeks with Steve Stockton.